This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents Journey to the Center of the Earth, written by Jules Verne, narrated by Tim Curry.
Chapter 1. It was on Sunday, the 24th of May, 1863, that my uncle, Professor Liedenbrock, came rushing suddenly back to his little house in the old part of Hamburg, number 19, Königstrasse. Our good Martha could not but think she was very much behindhand with the dinner, for the pot was scarcely beginning to simmer, and I said to myself, "Now then, we'll have a fine outcry if my uncle is hungry, for he is the most impatient of mortals." "Mr. Liedenbrock already?" cried the poor woman, in dismay, half opening the dining-room door. "Yes, Martha, but of course dinner can't be ready yet, for it is not 2 o'clock. It has only just struck the half-hour by St. Michael's."
"Well, what brings Mr. Liedenbrock home, then?"
"He'll probably tell us that himself."
"Here he comes. I'll be off, Mr. Axel. You must make him listen to reason."
And forthwith she effected a safe retreat to her culinary laboratory. I was left alone, but not feeling equal to the task of making the most irascible of professors listen to reason, was about to escape to my own little room upstairs, when the street door creaked on its hinges, and the wooden stairs cracked beneath a hurried tread, and the master of the house came in and bolted across the dining room, straight into his study. But, rapid as his flight was, he managed to fling his nutcracker-headed stick into a corner, and his wide-brimmed rough hat on the table, and to shout out to his nephew, "Axel, follow me!" Before I had time to stir, he called out again, in the most impatient tone imaginable, "What? Not here yet?" In an instant I was on my feet, and in the study of my dreadful master. Otto Liedenbrock was not a bad man. I grant that, willingly. But unless he mightily changes, he will live and die a terrible original. He was professor in the Johanneum, and gave the course of lectures on mineralogy, during which he regularly put himself into a passion once or twice. Not that he troubled himself much about the assiduity of his pupils, or the amount of attention they paid to his lessons, or their corresponding success. These points gave him no concern. He taught subjectively, to use a German philosophical expression, for himself, and not for others. He was a selfish savant, a well of science, and nothing could be drawn up from it without the grinding noise of the pulleys. In a word, he was a miser. There are professors of this stamp in Germany. My uncle, unfortunately, did not enjoy great facility of pronunciation, unless he was with intimate friends, at least not when he spoke in public, and this is a deplorable defect in an orator. In his demonstrations at the Johanneum, the professor would often stop short, struggling with some obstinate word that refused to slip over his lips, one of those words which resist, swell out, and finally come forth in the anything but scientific shape of an oath. This put him in a great rage. Now, in mineralogy, there are many names difficult to pronounce, half Greek, half Latin, barbarous appellations which would blister the lips of a poet. I have no wish to speak ill of the science, far from it, but when one has to do with rhomboidal crystallizations, retinasphaltic resins, galena favosite, molybdates of lead, tungstates of manganese, and titanites of zircon, the most nimble tongue may be allowed to stumble. The townsfolk were aware of this pardonable infirmity of my uncle's, and they took advantage of it, and were on the watch for the dangerous passages. and when he put himself in a fury, laughed at him, which was not in good taste, even for Germans. His lectures were always very numerously attended, but how many of those who were most regular auditors came for anything else but to make game of the professor's grand fits of passion, I shouldn't like to say. Whatever my uncle might be, and I can hardly say too much, he was a true savant. Though he sometimes broke his specimens by his rough handling, he had both the genius of a geologist and the eye of a mineralogist. With his hammer and steel pointer and magnetic needle, his blowpipe and his flask of nitric acid, he was a master indeed. By the fracture, the hardness, the fusibility, the ring, the smell of any mineral whatever, he classed it, without hesitation, among the 600 species science numbers today. The name of Liddenbrock was consequently mentioned with honour in gymnasiums and national associations. Humphrey Davy, Humboldt, and Captains Franklin and Sabine made him a visit when they passed through Hamburg. Becquoy, Ebelmann, Brewster, Dumas, Milne Edwards, Sainte Clarisse de Ville took pleasure in consulting him on the most stirring questions of chemistry, a science which was indebted to him for discoveries of considerable importance. And in 1853, a treatise on transcendent crystallography by Professor Otto Liddenbrock was published at Leipzig, a large folio with plates, which did not pay its cost, however. Moreover, my uncle was curator of the Museum of Mineralogy, belonging to M. Struve, the Russian ambassador, a valuable collection of European celebrity. Such, then, was the personage who summoned me so impatiently. Fancy to yourself a tall, spare man, with an iron constitution and a juvenile fairness of complexion, which took off full 10 years of his 50. His large eyes rolled about incessantly behind his great goggles. His long, thin nose resembled a knife blade. Malicious people declared it was magnetized and attracted steel filings, a pure calumny. It attracted nothing but snuff, but, to speak truth, a superabundance of that. When I have added that my uncle made mathematical strides of 3 feet at every step, and marched along with his fists firmly clenched, a sign of an impetuous temperament, you will know enough of him not to be over-anxious for his company. He lived in his little house in Königstrasse, a dwelling built partly of brick and partly of stone, with a crenated gable end, which looked onto one of those winding canals which intersect each other in the centre of the oldest part of Hamburg, which happily escaped the Great Fire in 1842. The old house leaned forward slightly, and bulged out towards the passers-by. The roof inclined to one side, in the position a German student belonging to the Tugendbund wears his cap. The perpendicular of the house was not quite exact, but on the whole the house stood well enough, thanks to an old elm, firmly embedded in the façade, which pushed its flower buds across the window panes in spring. My uncle was pretty rich for a German professor. The house was his own, and all its belongings. These belongings were his godchild, Greuben, a Fierland girl, 17 years old, his servant Martha, and myself. In my double quality of nephew and orphan, I became his assistant in his experiments. I must confess I have a great appetite for geological science. The blood of a mineralogist flows in my veins, and I never grow weary in the society of my beloved stones. On the whole, it was possible to live happily in this little house in Königstrasse, notwithstanding the impatience of the owner, for though he had a rough fashion of showing it, he loved me for all that. But the fact was, he was a man who could not wait, and was in a greater hurry than nature. When he used to plant mignonette and convolvuluses in his terracotta pots in the spring, every morning he went regularly and pulled their leaves to hasten their growth. With such an original, there was no alternative but to obey, so I darted into the study immediately. Chapter 2. The study was a complete museum. Every specimen of the mineral kingdom was to be found there, all labelled in the most perfect order, in accordance with the three great divisions of minerals, the inflammable, the metallic, and the lithoid. How well I knew this alphabet of mineralogical science. How many a time, instead of loitering about with boys of my own age, I amused myself by dusting these graphites and anthracites and pit coal and touchstones and the bitumens and the resins and organic soils, which had to be kept from the least particle of dust, and the metals, from iron up to gold, the relative value of which disappeared before the absolute equality of scientific specimens. And all those stones, enough to build the little house in the Königstrasse over again, and an extra room besides, which I would have fitted up so nicely for myself. When I entered the study now, I scarcely thought of these wonders. My mind was entirely occupied with my uncle. He had buried himself in his big armchair, covered with Utrecht velvet, and held a book in his hands, gazing at it with the most profound admiration.
"What a book! What a book!" he exclaimed.
This reminded me that Professor Liddenbrock was also given to bibliomania in his leisure moments. But an old book would have had no value in his eyes unless it could not be found anywhere else, or, at all events, could not be read.
"What? Don't you see it, then?"
he went on.
"It is a priceless treasure. I discovered it this morning while I was rummaging about in Hevelin's, the Jew's shop."
"Magnificent," I replied, with forced enthusiasm. Really, what was the good of making such a fuss about an old quarto volume, the back and sides of which seemed bound in coarse calf? A yellowish old book, with a faded tassel dangling from it. However, the professor's vocabulary of adjectives was not yet exhausted.
"Look,"
he said, asking himself questions and answering them in the same breath.
"Is it handsome enough?" "Yes, it is first rate. And what binding! Does it open easily?" "Yes, it lies open at any page, no matter where." "And does it close well?" "Yes, for binding and leaves seem in one completely. Not a single breakage in this back after 700 years of existence. Ah, this is a binding that Bazarian, Kloss, and Pergold might have been proud of."
And all the while he was speaking, my uncle kept opening and shutting the old book. I could not do less than ask him about the contents, though I did not feel the least interest in the subject. "And what is the title of this wonderful volume?" I asked.
"The title of it?" he replied, with increased animation. "The title is Heims Kringla, by Snorre Turleson, the famous Icelandic author of the 12th century. It is the chronicle of the Norwegian princes who reigned in Iceland."
"Indeed," I said, doing my best to appear enthusiastic. "And it is translated into German, of course."
"Translated?" cried the professor in a sharp tone. "What should I do with the translation? Who cares for translations? It is the original work, in the Icelandic, that magnificent idiom at once grand and simple, which allows of the most varied grammatical combinations and most numerous modification of words."
"Like German," I said, making a lucky hit.
"Yes," replied my uncle, shrugging his shoulders, "without taking into account that the Icelandic language has the three numbers like the Greek and declines proper names like the Latin."
"Does it?" said I, a little roused from my indifference. "And is the type good?"
type? Who is talking of type, you poor, ignorant Axel?
So you suppose this was printed? You ignoramus, it is a manuscript, and a runic manuscript, too.
Runic?
Yes.
Are you going to ask me to explain that word next?
Not if I know it, I replied, in a tone of wounded vanity. But my uncle never heeded me, and went on with his instructions, telling me about things I did not care to know. The runic characters were formerly used in Iceland, and according to tradition, were invented by Odin himself. Look at them, and admire them, impious young man. These types sprang from the imagination of a god.
The only reply I could think of was to prostrate myself, for this sort of answer must be as pleasing to gods as to men, since it has the advantage of never embarrassing them. But before I could do this, the current of the conversation was changed in an instant by the sudden appearance of a dirty parchment, which slipped out of the old book and fell on the floor. My uncle pounced on this treasure with avidity, as can easily be supposed. An ancient document, shut up in an old volume, perhaps from time immemorial, could not fail to be of priceless value in his eyes.
"What is this?" he exclaimed, carefully spreading out on his table a piece of parchment 5 inches long and 3 wide, on which some incomprehensible characters were inscribed in long transverse lines. I give the exact facsimile, for great importance attaches to these fantastic marks, as they led Professor Lidenbrock and his nephew to undertake the strangest expedition of the 19th century. The professor looked at the queer characters for some minutes, and then pushed up his spectacles and said, "It is runic. These marks are exactly like those in the manuscript of Snorre Turlison."
"But what can they mean?" As runic appeared to me an invention of learned men to mystify the poor world, I was not sorry to see that my uncle could not decipher it. At least I judged so, from the convulsive working of his fingers.
"Yet it is the ancient Icelandic," he muttered to himself.
And Professor Lidenbrock could not but know this, for he was considered a veritable polyglot. Not that he could speak fluently the 2,000 languages and 4,000 dialects used on the surface of the globe, but he was familiar with a good part of them. A difficulty like this, then, was sure to rouse all the impetuosity of his nature, and I was just expecting a violent scene when 2 o'clock struck, and Martha opened the study door and said,
"Soup is on the table. Pitch the soup to the devil and the cook, too, and those who eat it."
Martha fled, and I scampered after her, and hardly knowing how, found myself in my accustomed seat in the dining room. I waited a few minutes. The professor did not come. This was the first time, to my knowledge, that he had ever neglected the grave business of dinner. And what a dinner, too! Parsley soup, a ham omelette, and sorrel à la muscade, a loin of veal, and a compote of plums, and for dessert, crevette au sucre, and all washed down with sparkling Moselle wine. All this was what my uncle was going to lose for the sake of an old paper. Really, as a devoted nephew, I felt obliged to do his share of eating as well as my own, and I did it conscientiously.
"I never saw the like of this," exclaimed our good Martha. "Mr. Lidenbrock not to come to dinner. It is incredible. This bodes something serious," went on the old servant, shaking her head.
In my opinion, it boded nothing except a frightful outbreak when my uncle found his dinner devoured. I was just finishing my last crevette when a loud thundering summons tore me away from my voluptuous enjoyment. I made one bound into the study. Chapter 3. It is evidently runic, said the professor, knitting his brows. But there is a secret in it, and I will discover it, or else...
A violent gesture completed his sentence.
Sit down there,
he added, pointing to the table with his fist,
and write.
I was ready in an instant.
Now then, I am going to dictate to you each letter of our alphabet, which corresponds to one of these Icelandic characters. We shall see what that will give us. But by St. Michael, take care you make no mistake.
The dictation commenced. I did my best. Every letter was called out one after another, and formed an incomprehensible succession of words. When I had finished it, my uncle snatched the paper from me and examined it attentively a long time.
"What can it mean?"
he repeated mechanically. On my honour, I could not tell him. Besides, he did not ask me. He was speaking to himself.
"It is what we call a cryptogram, where the meaning is concealed by confusing the letters designedly, and to make an intelligible sentence, they must be arranged in proper order. To think that here perhaps lies the explanation or indication of some great discovery."
For my own part, I thought it was absolute nonsense, but I was wise enough to keep my opinion to myself. The professor took up the book and the parchment again and compared them.
"The two writings are not done by the same hand," he said. "The cryptogram is of later date than the book. On the very face of it, there is an irrefragable proof of it. The first letter is a double M, which would be sought in vain in Turlison's book, for it was only added to the Icelandic alphabet in the 14th century. Consequently, there are at least 200 years between the manuscript and the document."
This certainly seemed logical enough.
"I therefore come to the conclusion," continued my uncle, "that these mysterious characters were inscribed by someone who came into possession of the book. But who on earth was it? Could he have put his name, I wonder, in any part of the manuscript?"
And my uncle pushed up his spectacles, and taking a powerful magnifying glass, began to examine carefully the first pages of the book. On the back of the first leaf, he discovered a spot which looked like a blot of ink, but on closer inspection, sundry letters, half obliterated, could be distinguished. My uncle saw instantly that this was the chief point of interest, and fastened on it furiously, poring over it through his big magnifying glass, till at last he made out the marks, runic characters, which he read off immediately.
"Arne Saknussemm," he cried, in a triumphant tone. "Why, that is a name, and an Icelandic name, too, that of a celebrated alchemist, a savant, who lived in the 16th century."
I looked at my uncle with a feeling of admiration.
"These alchemists," he went on, "Avicenna, Bacon, Lully, Paracelsus, were the only savants of their time. They made discoveries which may well astonish us. Why should not this Saknussemm have hidden under this incomprehensible cryptogram the secret of some surprising invention? It must be so. It is."
The professor's imagination was enkindled at this hypothesis.
"No doubt," I ventured to reply. "But what interest could the savant have in concealing a wonderful discovery?" "Why? Why? Aha! Don't I know? Didn't Galileo act so about Saturn? Besides, we shall soon see. I will get the secret of this document. I will neither eat nor sleep till I find it out."
"Oh," thought I.
"No more shall you, Axel." "Plague it," said I to myself. "It's a good job I have had a dinner for two today." "The first thing to be done," said my uncle, "is to find the language of the cipher."
I pricked up my ears at this. My uncle continued his soliloquy.
"Nothing is easier. In this document there are 132 letters, in which there are 79 consonants and 53 vowels.
Now, this is just about the proportion found in the words of southern languages, while the northern idioms are far richer in consonants. Consequently, this must be in a southern language. His conclusions were very just. But what language is it? It was this I waited for him to tell me, for I knew he was a profound analyst. This Saknussemm, he went on, was a learned man, and since he did not write in his mother tongue, he would be sure to employ the language in common use among the cultivated minds of the 16th century. I mean, the Latin. If I am mistaken, I could try the Spanish, the French, the Italian, the Greek, the Hebrew. But the learned in the 16th century generally wrote in Latin. I may rightly then say, a priori, this is in Latin. I started, for my recollections of Latinity revolted against the pretension of this assemblage of uncouth words to belong to the soft tongue of Virgil. Yes, Latin, repeated my uncle, but tangled Latin. So be it, thought I. And if you disentangle it, my uncle, you'll be clever. Let us examine it thoroughly, he said, taking up the sheet again on which I had been writing. Here are 132 letters in evident disorder. In some words, there are nothing but consonants, as in the first, mrnrls. Others, where the vowels, on the contrary, abound. The fifth, for example, untref, or the last but one, osebo. Now, this arrangement has, clearly, not been designed. It is the mathematical result of the unknown law which ruled the succession of these letters. It seems to me certain that the primitive phrase has been written regularly and then turned upside down according to some law I must find out. Anyone who had the key of the cipher could read it fluently. But where is the key? Have you got it, Axel? I made no reply, and for a good reason. My gaze was fixed on a portrait hanging on the wall opposite me, the portrait of Greuben, my uncle's ward, who was just now at Altona on a visit to her relations, and her absence made me very unhappy, for, I may as well confess it now, the pretty Fiolandaise and the professor's nephew loved each other with true German patience and placidity. We were betrothed, though unknown to my uncle, who was too much of a geologist to understand such sentiments. Greuben was a charming young girl, a blonde, with blue eyes, rather inclined to be grave and solemn, but loving me none the less for that. For my part, I worshipped her, if there is such a word in the Teutonic language. The image of my little Fiolandaise transported me in an instant from the world of realities to a world of fancies and memories. I could see my faithful companion in labors and pastimes. Every day she helped me to put my uncle's precious collection of stones in order and put on the labels. Indeed, Miss Greuben was quite a mineralogist. She would have put more than one savant to the blush. She loved to dive into the deepest questions of science. What delightful hours we had spent in studying together, and how often I had envied the unconscious stones handled by her charming hands. And when our tasks were over, how we used to go out and wander along the shady walks by the Ulster, and then repair to the old black tarred mill, which looked so picturesque at the far end of the lake, chatting all the way and holding each other's hands. I used to tell her droll stories, which made her laugh heartily, and beguiled the time till we reached the banks of the Elbe, and after saying good night to the swans, which swim about among the tall white irises, we returned to the quay of the steamboat. I had just got to this point when my daydream was rudely interrupted by a violent rap on the table from my uncle's knuckles, which recalled me to reality. "Look here," he said. "It seems to me that if one wished to mix up and confuse any sentence, the first thing he would think of would be to write the words vertically instead of horizontally, in groups of five or six. Indeed, thought I. We must see what that makes. Write some sentence on this bit of paper, but instead of putting the letters one after the other, put them in vertical columns, grouping them in numbers of five or six. I understood what he meant, and immediately wrote from top to bottom, J-E-T-A-I-M-E-B-I-E-N-comma-M-A-P-E-T-I-T-E-G-R-A-umlaut-U-B-E-N! I love thee well, my little Gräuben. Very good, said the professor without reading it. Now, arrange these words in horizontal lines. I obeyed, and this sentence was the result. Jiminiger, Eteren, Tabimiaya, Ayatu, Yepeb. Perfectly so, said my uncle, seizing the paper from my hands. This has the look of the old document already. Vowels and consonants are grouped in the same disorder. There are even capitals in the same way in the middle of words, and also commas, exactly as in the parchment of Saknussemm. I could not but think these remarks very ingenious. Now then, said my uncle, addressing me, I don't know what sentence you have written, but all I need to do to enable me to read it is to take the first letter of each word in succession, and then the second, and then the third, and so on. And to his great amazement, and certainly still more to mine, my uncle read, Je t'aime bien, ma petite Gräuben. Eh, what? Said the professor. Positively, like a lovesick fool, I had written this telltale sentence without knowing it. Ah, you love Gräuben, resumed the professor, in a thoroughly magisterial tone. Yes, no, I stammered out. Ah, you love Gräuben, he repeated mechanically. Well, well, let us try my method with the document in question. My uncle was completely absorbed again in his subject of contemplation, and had already forgotten my imprudent words. I say imprudent, for a savant's head cannot understand affaire du cœur. But fortunately the great business of the document carried him away completely. Professor Lidenbrock's eyes flashed like lightning through his spectacles, and his fingers trembled as he took up the old parchment again to make his important experiment. He was greatly excited. At last he coughed violently, and in a grave tone read out the following letters, naming successively the first of each word, and then the second, and so on, as he had done in my unfortunate sentence. Mimesunka senra eisfdo ke signitar murten eskert esert serete rotaiv sadua ed nec sedded sadne la cartni flu fsir on track sa mutabiled mec. Meretax iluco islefen snyai. I must confess, I felt excited as I ended the series. The letters themselves, named one by one, sounded perfectly meaningless, but I fully expected to hear my uncle come out in a pompous style with some magnificent piece of Latinity. But who could have thought it? Instead of this, a tremendous thump of his fist sent the table spinning, jerked out the ink, and made my pen fly out of my hands. "That's not it!" he thundered out. "It does not make sense!" Next minute, he was off like a shot, rushing down the stairs with the speed of an avalanche, and away out into the street as fast as his legs could carry him.
Chapter 4
"He is gone!"
cried Martha, running up to see what the noise was about, for the door closed with such a bang that it shook the house from top to bottom.
"Yes," I replied, "clean gone."
"And without his dinner?"
"He won't have any."
"Nor supper either?"
said the old domestic.
"Nor supper either," I said.
"What?"
exclaimed Martha, clasping her hands.
"No, my good Martha, he will neither eat any more himself, nor allow anyone else in the house to eat."
"Goodness me! Then there is nothing for us but starvation?"
I did not dare to say that with such an autocrat as my uncle this was our inevitable fate. The old servant was evidently alarmed, however, and went back to her kitchen, sighing. Now that I was alone, the thought came into my head that I would go and tell Gräuben the whole affair. But how could I get away? The professor might be back any moment. And suppose he called me and wanted to recommence his logogryphical labours, which old Oedipus himself would not have undertaken. And if I am not forthcoming, what would be the consequence? My wisest plan was to stay, and I had plenty to do, for a mineralogist in Besançon had just forwarded us a collection of silicious nodules, which had to be classified. I set to work, picking out, labelling, and arranging in their glass case all these hollow stones, full of small, glittering crystals. But this occupation did not engross me entirely. Strangely enough, I could not get the old document out of my mind. My brain was disturbed, and an uneasy feeling began to steal over me. I had the presentiment of some approaching catastrophe. In the course of an hour, all the stones were in their right places, and I ensconced myself in the large velvet easy-chair, swinging myself and throwing back my head. I lighted my hookah, the carved bowl of which represented a naiad reclining carelessly. I amused myself with watching the progress of carbonization, which was gradually turning my naiad into a thorough negress, and kept listening for footsteps on the stair, but there was not a sound. Where could my uncle be? I fancied him striding along the road to Altona, among the beautiful trees, gesticulating and making cuts at the wall with his stick, thrashing the grass vigorously, nipping off the tops of the thistles, and disturbing the tranquillity of the solitary stalks. Would he come back triumphant or dejected? Would he master the secret or give it up? As I was thus questioning myself, I mechanically took up the paper on which I had written the incomprehensible series of letters, and I said, "What can this mean?" I tried to group the letters so as to form words. It was impossible. Let me arrange them as I might, putting two or three or five or six together, I could make no intelligible sense. True, the 14th, 15th, and 16th would make the English word ice, and the 83rd, 84th, and 85th would make sir. And also in the middle of the document, I noticed the Latin words rota, mutabile, ira, nec, atra. "Hang it," I said to myself. "These last words certainly do go to prove my uncle is right about the language in which this document is written." And in the fourth line again, I noticed the word luco, which means the sacred wood. On the other hand, I read in the third line the word tabiled, a thoroughly Hebrew expression, and on the last, the vocables mère, arc, mère, which are pure French. It was enough to craze one. Four different idioms in this meaningless sentence. What connection could there be between the words ice, sir, colère, cruel, sacred wood, chair, grant, mère, arc, or mère? The first and the last might easily be brought together, since there was nothing astonishing in finding a sea of ice mentioned in a document written in Iceland. But for understanding the remainder of the cryptogram, that was quite another thing. I fought and fought with this insurmountable difficulty, gazing fixedly at the document till my brain grew giddy, and the letters seemed whirling round my head. A sort of hallucination came over me. I felt stifled, as if from want of air, and involuntarily began to fan myself with the sheet of paper. The back and front of it alternately met my eye, and as it waved rapidly to and fro, I fancied I could see on the back some perfectly legible Latin words, amongst others, craterem and terrestre. Light broke in on my mind instantly. I caught a glimpse of the clue. I had found the key to the cipher. To understand this document, it was not even necessary to read it through the back of the page. No, just as it was, exactly as he had dictated it to me, it could be spelt out easily. The professor was right in his arrangement of the letters, and right about the language of the document. A mere nothing would enable him to read the whole sentence fluently, and this mere nothing chance had just revealed to me. It may be imagined how excited I was. My eyes began to swim, and I could hardly see. I had spread out the paper on the table, and one glance would make me possessor of the secret. At last, I managed to calm myself somewhat. I made myself walk twice around the room to quiet my nerves, and then dropped again into the capacious armchair. "Now then, we'll read it," I exclaimed, taking a long breath. I leaned over the table, and placing my finger on each letter in succession, read the whole sentence aloud. But what stupefaction, what terror seized me! I sat motionless, as if paralyzed. What? Had anyone really ever done what I had just read? Had any mortal man been bold enough to make the search? But no, no, I cried, leaping up from my chair. My uncle shall not know it. He would not be satisfied with the mere knowledge of the fact. He would undertake the journey for himself. Nothing could hinder him. Such a daring geologist as he is would start off in spite of everything, come what might, and he would drag me with him, and we should never return. Never, never. I cannot describe my state of agitation. No, no, that shall never be, I said passionately. And since I can prevent my tyrant from getting such a notion into his head, I will. If he were to begin twisting and turning the document about, he might chance to discover the key. We'll destroy it. There was still a spark of fire in the grate. I snatched up both the sheet of paper and the parchment of Saknussemm, and with a feverish hand was just going to fling them on the hot embers and make an entire end of the dangerous secret, when the study opened and my uncle appeared. Chapter 5. I had only just time to replace the unfortunate document on the table. Professor Liddenbrock seemed absorbed in his own meditations. His ruling thought allowed him not a moment's respite. He had evidently been poring over the subject and analyzing it, and bringing all the resources of his imagination to bear upon it during his walk, and he had come back to try some new combination. In fact, he was no sooner in than he seated himself in his armchair, and taking up his pen, began a fresh formula, which resembled some algebraic calculation. My eyes followed his trembling hand. Not one of his movements escaped me. What unhoped-for result was he suddenly about to produce? I trembled, and yet needlessly, for since the right combination and the only one had already been found, all further search must of necessity be useless. For 3 long hours my uncle continued his labours without speaking or even lifting his hand, blotting out and doing again, erasing and making a fresh beginning 1,000 times. I knew quite well that if he succeeded in arranging the letters in all the relative positions they could occupy, the right sentence would come out. But I also knew that 20 letters only can form 2 quintillions, 432 quadrillions, 902 trillions, 8 billions, 1175 millions, 640,000 combinations. Now, there were 132 letters in the sentence, and these 132 letters would make a number of different sentences composed of 133 ciphers at least, a number almost impossible to enumerate or adequately conceive. I therefore reassured myself on the score of this heroic method of solving the problem. However, the time passed away, and night drew on. The noisy street had become still, but my uncle, still stooping down over his task, saw nothing, not even his good old Martha, when she ventured to open the door partially and say,
"Will you take any supper, sir?"
He never heard her, and the worthy old servant had to go away without getting an answer. For myself, I held up as long as I could, but at last weariness overpowered me completely, and I fell sound asleep on the end of the sofa, while my uncle still continued his calculations and erasures. When I woke next morning, the indefatigable worker was still at his task. His red eyes and wan face and wild disordered hair, through which he was constantly drawing his feverish fingers, and the crimson spots on his cheeks, all told the story of a terrible struggle with the impossible. Really, he moved my pity. I could not but feel for him, much as I might justly blame him. The poor man was so completely engrossed with one idea that he forgot to put himself in a passion. All the vital powers were concentrated on one single point, and I began to fear the long strain on them, without any escape by their usual safety valve, would positively end in some internal explosion. I could have relaxed this tension by a single gesture or word, and yet I did not. Still, I was acting from a kind motive. For my uncle's sake, I remained silent. "No, no," I said to myself, "I won't say a word." He would want to go then. I know he would. He would risk his life to do what no other geologist has done. I'll say nothing about it. I will keep this secret chance has revealed to me. It would be the professor's death. Let him guess it if he can. I'll not have to reproach myself at any rate with having disclosed it. My resolution taken, I crossed my arms and waited. But I was not prepared for a circumstance which occurred some hours later. When Martha went to go out as usual to market, she found the door locked. The great key was gone. Who had taken it? My uncle must, of course, when he returned from his hasty walk the night before. But had he taken it purposely, or through inadvertence? Did he really want to subject us to the horrors of starvation? This seemed to me going too far. Were Martha and I to be victimized for what did not concern us in the least? No doubt of it, for I remembered a precedent which might well frighten us. Some years before, when my uncle was engaged on his great mineralogical classification, he ate nothing whatever for 48 hours, and made his entire household feed on this scientific diet. I well remember the sharp twinges in my internal regions I got through it, for such diet was not very satisfying for a boy like me, naturally inclined to be rather voracious. It certainly appeared we would have to dispense with breakfast, as we had with supper the preceding night. However, I determined to be heroic, and stand out in spite of hunger. Martha was quite distressed, and looked very grave over it. What troubled me most was that I could not get out of the house. That was a great grievance, as may easily be supposed. My uncle still laboured on. His imagination was wandering in the ideal world of combinations. He lived above the earth, and really above earthly wants. Towards noon, the pangs of hunger made themselves seriously felt. Martha, innocently enough, had eaten up all that was left in the larder the night before. There was nothing whatever in the house. I still stood out, though. I made it a point of honour. 2 o'clock struck. The thing was becoming ridiculous and even intolerable. I began to see matters in a different light, and thought I had been exaggerating the importance of the document, that my uncle would not believe in it, that he would consider it a mere hoax, and that even if the worst came to the worst, and he wished to attempt the adventurous journey, he could be prevented by main force. And finally, I thought he may, perhaps, discover the secret for himself, and I shall only get fasting for my pains. These appeared excellent reasons to me now, though the night before I had rejected them indignantly. I even thought I had been acting absurdly in waiting so long, and determined to give the solution of the mystery without further delay. I was just waiting for a suitable opportunity, not wishing to be too abrupt, when the professor got up and, taking his hat, was about to go out. What? Was I going to let him leave the house and shut us all in again? Never. Uncle, I said. He did not seem to hear me. Uncle Lidenbrock, I repeated in a louder tone. Eh? What? He said, like a man suddenly roused from sleep. Well, have you got the key? What key? The key of the door? No, I replied. The key of the document. The professor looked at me above his spectacles and no doubt noticed something unusual in my face, for he seized my arm sharply, and without saying a word gazed at me inquiringly. Never was question put more plainly. I nodded my head. He shook his in a pitying sort of manner, as if he thought he had to do with a fool. I made a still more affirmative gesture. His eyes sparkled, and his grip became threatening. This mute conversation of ours would have interested the most indifferent spectator, and really I hardly dared to speak now, for I was afraid he would stifle me with embraces in his joy. But he became so pressing that I was forced to reply. Yes, I said, this key has by chance... What are you saying? He cried, with indescribable agitation. Here, take this, I replied, handing him the piece of paper on which I had written what he dictated. Read. But there is no sense in that, he said, crushing up the paper. No, not if you begin at the beginning, but if you begin at the end. Before I had time to finish the sentence, the professor gave a cry, or rather I should say a perfect roar. A revelation had come to him. He looked transfigured. Ah! Ingenious Saknussemm! He exclaimed. Your phrase was written backwards then. And snatching up the sheet, he read in tones full of emotion the entire document, beginning at the last letter. It was as follows. In snuffles joculis craterum rem delibat umbra. Scartaris Julii intra calendas descende audas viator et terrestres centrum attinges. Cod feci. Anne sacnusum. Bad Latin, which may be translated thus. Descend the crater of the Jökull of Snæfell, that the shadow of Scartaris softly touches before the calends of July, bold traveller, and thou wilt reach the centre of the earth, which I have done. Arne Saknussemm. My uncle gave a leap as he read this, as if suddenly touched by a Leyden jar. He was magnificent in his joy and daring and conviction. He went up and down the room, clasped his hands over his head, moved about the chairs, piled up the books. It seemed almost incredible, but he began to toss about his precious specimens of stones. He gave a thump with his fist here and a tap there. At last he grew calmer and sank down in his armchair as if exhausted. "What time is it?" he asked after a brief silence. 3 o'clock, I replied. Stop! I have had no dinner. I'm starving. Let us go have it at once, and then afterwards...
Afterwards?
Pack my trunk.
Hey,
What? I cried. And your own, too, added the merciless professor, as he passed into the dining room.
Chapter 6. These words made me shudder, but I restrained myself and resolved to put a good face on it. Only scientific arguments would be of any avail with Professor Lidenbrock. But such arguments there were, and good ones, against the possibility of such a journey. To go to the center of the earth? What folly! However, I reserved my dialectics for a fitting moment, and concerned myself about dinner. It would be useless to repeat my uncle's imprecations when he found a bare table. All was explained, and our worthy domestic was forthwith liberated. She hurried immediately to the market and made such successful